Welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast. Since the result of the EU referendum was announced back in June, the UK media has reported a large upswing in the number of hate crimes being reported. One of the trends that has been noted is a particularly high occurrence of such incidents in areas that voted Leave. But in his cover piece, Brendan O'Neill argues that there is an unhinged subjectivity to hate crime reporting, which has skewed statistics in favour of self-critical moralisation. So, has there really been a post-Brexit surge in hostility towards minority groups? Or is our metric for recording these crimes simply off-kilter? I'm joined now by Brendan O'Neill and Kevin O'Sullivan, who was recently cleared after spending 20 months defending himself from a hate crime allegation. So, Brendan, what actually is a hate crime?
That's a good question. It's pretty much anything. It's entirely subjective. And the thing that really amazes me, the thing I've written about, is how, you know, everyone always moans about the fact that we live in a post-truth world and everything's supposed to be evidence-based and we're all supposed to be obsessed with facts. But when it comes to hate crime, that all goes out of the window. And it's all entirely down to the perception of the victim. So if the victim feels that he or she was subjected to a hate crime, then they were. That's the bottom line. Their word is gospel. And, I mean, they actually say this in police procedures and policies. They actually say you don't need to have evidence to prove hatred as a motivating factor in a crime. You simply have to take the victim's word for it. So that opens up a whole kind of Orwellian subjective free-for-all, which means that pretty much anyone, for saying almost anything, could have the hate crime finger pointed at them. It's quite Stalinist, actually.
It's terrifying. And Kevin, you were accused of a hate crime.
Yeah, I was the victim of this very syndrome. And as Brendan says, the definition is if anyone perceives, not only if the alleged victim, it should be, but of course they're referred to as the victim, or anyone perceives hate crime to have been committed, then it is a hate crime. It reminds me of that historic sex definition, you know, you will be believed. So if you go to the police and you say somebody subjected me to a hate crime, racist, homophobic, transphobic, whatever, you will be believed. Or as I found out, if you deny it, you will not be believed. It is a ludicrous system. And when you're stuck in the middle of it, as I was for 20 horrific months, it is Kafkaesque and extremely unfair. It is, in terms of British justice, it's a disgrace. It's an absolute disgrace. It cost me £15,000 to get off completely unfounded, completely unproven, impossible to prove claims by a man who just told lies about me.
And obviously, post-Brexit, everyone's been talking about how there's been an epidemic of hate crime, but Brendan, you dispute that in your piece.
Yeah, it's not true, I don't think. I mean, Britain is a really tolerant place. When I first got involved in politics in the early 1990s, the thing I did was campaign against racism. Marched on the streets, handed out leaflets, that's the thing I did. And racism, even then, that's not that long ago, racism then was more open than it is now. In the 20 years since then, things have got much better. We live in a far more tolerant, pluralistic, I would say, mostly peaceful society. And yet the authorities and the police and journalists and academics are hell-bent on convincing us that actually we're a really hateful society and everyone is out to get you and prejudice and racism are everywhere. And it's just not true. It's not stood up by the facts at all. I think Kevin's absolutely right that there's a real Salem-like atmosphere around this. It brings to mind Arthur Miller's line from The Crucible, "Is the word of the accuser sacred now?" Yes, it is. The word of the accuser is now sacred. I mean, the police actually say that. So what's that has done has opened up this kind of crazy situation where anyone can find themselves dragged before the courts for something they said or something they did, even if it was entirely innocent and even if there was no hatred behind it. The thing that terrifies me most is that all the people, like lefties and academics and liberals who in the 1970s and 80s were always challenging moral panics and crime panics and challenging the crime construction, they've completely bought into the hate crime idea. They're uncritical in relation to it. They have not deployed their critical faculties that they did in relation to the Teddy Boy crime panic or the football hooligan crime panic or the black muggers crime panic. This is a crime panic that they've completely bought into, which means there is really little kickback against it. And I find that really worrying.
And in your case, Kevin, when the police were looking into it, was there any point where they said, actually, there's no evidence, what the hell are we doing?
This is what's so terrifying. Every piece of evidence that such as it as they were proved that he was talking rubbish. He just made this stuff up. I have no idea what his motivations were, although I do remember after our silly little skirmish on a train, he referred to me as privileged. I think he'd pigeonholed me as a sort of flash, sort of right winger from London. I am from London, but I'm hardly the other two. And after that, the police pursued me with extraordinary zeal, and in all my dealings with them, I was saying, but look, you know, you can see on the CCTV that he accused me of interrupting him while making a call. He quite clearly never makes a call. He accused me of, you know, shouting at full volume for all the carriage to hear. He was the only one who heard, who allegedly heard us. And you are plunged, or I was plunged, with the police playing their full part into a world, a mad world, devoid of common sense. And what I think it is the police now have sort of redefined what they're for. They seem to feel that their primary role is to serve the perceived victim groups. So if you run into the police and said, I'm a victim of hate crime, or I'm a victim of historic sex abuse, you know, they will move heaven and earth to get you to court. And it's interesting that they don't define a not guilty verdict as a failure. They define success as getting it to court, or even getting someone like me charged. Any logical assessment of my case would have thrown it out at the word go. My lawyers said, we cannot believe this is still going on, but I'm afraid that the CPS and the police will conspire to get anyone who is unlucky enough to get on the wrong side of one of these hate crime criers to court. And then I've only today found out, it's infuriatingly, that they've written to all the witnesses in my case, pointing out that I was found not guilty, and saying, you must be, we realise you must be disappointed with this result. Why? Why do they?
As if
the witnesses are all gagging for convictions, as if they're as illiberal as the CPS and the police.
I think that's exactly right. And that points to the Stalinist element of this, because it's all about increasing crime records and getting more and more numbers on the books, regardless of whether anything actually happened,
Absolutely.
Anything hateful happened. Because it's about changing the role of the police, and it's actually about imbuing the authorities with a sense of purpose and a sense of mission, which they tend to lack these days. And through tackling hate crime, through presenting themselves as liberal and progressive and waging war against the hateful, stupid masses as they tend to see it, it gives them a sense of mission. That's really what this is about. And I think it's terrifying in terms of the authoritarian implications. Firstly, because anyone can be dragged into court and put through a terrible experience simply for saying something or not saying something. Also, it's given the police carte blanche to police speech on the internet. So as a kind of spin-off from the hate crime panic, the police now regularly trawl Facebook and Twitter and other online websites to look for hateful commentary, and they kind of knock on people's doors and say, stop saying this. Also, I also think that even when someone has committed a hateful crime, even when it is proven, which is a very difficult thing to do, even then, if they are given a higher sentence for that, I think that's also very authoritarian, because that really opens the door to thought crime. If you punch someone in the face and you get 2 years in prison, and then you punch someone in the face because you don't like black people and you get 3 years in prison, I actually have a problem with that, because what happens then is the state is punishing people for what they think, and so for their ideology, effectively. And I just think we are sleepwalking almost into a pretty Orwellian nightmare, where you can be punished for thought crime on the back of the hate crime panic, you can have your speech curtailed online, and you can go through the kind of experience Kevin's describing, which is this kind of Kafkaesque nightmare. The question that I keep coming back to is, where are the critical minds who are pulling this apart? Where's the modern day Stanley Cohen? You know, Stanley Cohen, the author of Folk Devils and Moral Panics, the great kind of classic sociological book of the 1970s. Where are those people? We really desperately need a few minds to pick this apart and raise some really important questions.
And we should remember that, you know, this post-Brexit spike in alleged hate crimes, obviously racist, you know, shouting nasty things at Polish people, etc., allegedly. This is because the police are writing down as a fully fledged hate crime every time someone rings them and said, I just saw someone in the street shouting something nasty about Polish people. So there's no perpetrator, there's no victim, there's no investigation, there's no trial, but there's a fully fledged statistic. And that's why we're being told that racism has got so much worse since Brexit. And, you know, you're quite right, Brendan. We are in the grip of something really rather frightening. I mean, personally, this is kind of beside the issue from my point of view, but I agree with you. I've always thought, you know, the whole principle of hate crime, i.e. saying something that you believe in and then being punished for it, is uncomfortable. And that when Tony Blair brought in those two laws in 1998 and 2003, we crossed a kind of Rubicon, because at that point we made saying things that you believe illegal. Now that is very, very disconcerting.
Yeah, and the bottom line is you should be free to hate people. Absolutely. That's the bottom line. Now, it's not big, it's not clever, it's often quite ugly, but it's an emotion, it's a feeling, it's an ideological way of life, it's a form of speech. And, of course, you should not be free to punch someone or to harass someone or to push someone or to stalk someone. All those things are already crimes. But you must be free to hate people. And what I think this does is it really invites the state to police thought itself, mm-hmm. and speech and emotion, how people feel about other people. That's not the role of the state. And if we allow it to become that role, then we're really going to regret that. I think the real problem, I think, with the hate crime panic is that it's doing the very thing it claims to be tackling, which is divides Britain, makes Britain a more tense, racialized place, because everyone is always thinking in this obsessive racial way. Should I speak to this person in a certain way? Should I avoid talking to that group of people because I might offend them? It actually heightens racial sensitivity at precisely a time when society is actually becoming far more chilled out and tolerant in relation to those issues. So I think this racialized politics of fear is actually dividing Britain and making it an intolerant place, potentially, which is a real disaster, because over the past 20 years or so, Britain has become more tolerant, more racially relaxed, more open, more multicultural. The hate crime industry is undermining that.
And talking of roles, I mean, why does the Director of Public Prosecutions, Alison Saunders, go on to Good Morning Britain, ITV's breakfast programme, to say that she wants to see more alleged hate criminals charged and prosecuted, and to quote, because she does think that not enough of these cases are being reported. How does she know that? Secondly, why is it her role to do that? Why are you whipping up the nation into a state of sort of hate crime vigilance? What on earth are you doing? How many does she want? I mean, actually, recent figures prove that these alleged hate crimes, although always remember the police don't, and the CPS don't refer to them as alleged. They're immediately a hate crime. They're being reported at the rate of more than 1,000 a week. How many does she want? 10,000? A million?
Yeah. I mean, it's
ridiculous.
It seems strange to me that on the one hand there's a sort of total disregard for evidence, but yet they're so keen on getting all these stats and kind of so they're sort of total opposite of
absolutely.
The way they're.
I mean, throughout my ordeal, you know, tellingly, I was referred to. The guy who told barefaced lies about me was referred to as the victim. I didn't start this. He started shouting at me. He went to get up. I was sublimely unaware of his very existence before he began his tirade, so I didn't start it. He actually punched me in the face first. Throughout it, I was referred to as the victim. He was referred to as the victim. I was referred to as the assailant. So the police and the CPS, if we want a better world, if we must make the best of this horrific situation, then they must approach or adopt a more sceptical approach and talk in terms of alleged victims, alleged crimes and alleged assailants. But they don't, because they like it to be a fait accompli from the word go in the sort of manner of that you will be believed culture.
And the term they always use is tip of the iceberg. This is what they, because, you know, there's this little bit we can see, but underneath that there's this huge, you know, iceberg levels of hatred and prejudice. And as you say, how do they know? They're just making it up. They're fantasizing. That. They're projecting their own kind of aloof, elitist fantasies that we are all a bunch of racists onto society. There's no proof for it whatsoever.
That was Brendan O'Neill and Kevin O'Sullivan. Despite headline-grabbing violence in Europe distracting attention away from the Middle East, the war in Syria shows no signs of abating.
In his piece this week, Paul Wood refers to the situation in Syria as the world's most complicated cat's cradle, with President Assad, Syrian rebel groups and Western forces often working at cross purposes. With the territorial gains of ISIS slowing down, is there any chance for military forces in the area to wrestle back control? Or will the convoluted internal politics of the conflict prevent a satisfactory conclusion from ever being reached? Joining us from Washington is Paul Wood, who has been covering the conflict for the past 4 years. So, Paul, ISIS now look like the losers. How has that happened?
It's been happening for quite a long time. Not surprising when you think that ISIS wanted to fight everybody. They wanted to fight the Americans. They wanted to fight other armed groups inside Syria and Iraq. And you just can't fight everybody and win. It's been especially effective that there's been a concerted air campaign against them. They have taken many, many losses at the same time as trying to battle other quite determined groups like Nusra. You can't keep going like that and expect to win.
And you mentioned Nusra in your piece and you suggest that they are actually coming out on top. How has that happened?
ISIS was so ideologically pure, so aggressive, many ordinary Syrians just didn't like that. Nusra were also quite effective against the regime, and there's an enduring suspicion that ISIS have got something to do with the regime. Nusra have got their own problems. Over the past couple of days, we've seen Nusra try to distance themselves from Al-Qaeda because the Americans have decided with Russia to start bombing Nusra. So Nusra have renamed themselves and talked about concentrating on the Syrian fight. I don't think this is going to fool the Americans. I think the Americans will still go ahead and bomb them.
And it seems to me that the conflict's obviously becoming so complicated now that it's quite hard to know who, you know, which side we're meant to be supporting. And you mentioned in your piece that the US basically seems to be fighting on both sides. Do you think that the Russian approach of picking one is better in a way?
For some people, this now comes down to whether you support President Assad, a dictator who has killed a couple of hundred thousand of his own people, according to some figures, or you support jihadi groups who ultimately have the West in their sights. For a lot of people, that means coming back to President Assad, and you wonder if some in Washington, although they don't want to say that publicly, that's the private calculation. There is a certain purity to the Russian approach, but of course they are supporting this dictator who's killed many, many of his own people.
And in your piece, you also mentioned Turkey and ISIS taking the fight to Turkey. How has that happened and why are they now sort of pushing on that front?
You have to acknowledge, first of all, that ISIS hasn't publicly claimed any of the attacks on Turkish soil. Nevertheless, there have been 7 attacks attributed to ISIS. There could be many reasons for that, one of which is it's just individual ISIS members deciding, well, we're going to kill some foreigners, let's go and bomb the airport in Istanbul, and this not being decided at any central and high level in ISIS. Because if it's the strategy of the leadership, it just doesn't make any sense. ISIS needs Turkey. It needs to be able to come and go from Turkey. It needs to be able to send its volunteers through Turkey, something it was doing quite happily for a couple of years. So it simply makes no sense to attack Turkey, yet this has clearly been happening. Another reason why ISIS over the past year or so has been losing ground and may ultimately lose the caliphate that it declared in 2014.
And obviously also in your piece you mentioned the kind of materialistic seductions of ISIS. Can you talk a bit about, you know, how that's playing out, and is there anything the West can do to challenge that particular aspect of this conflict?
There's one FSA commander I knew called Abu Walid, and Abu Walid was this young, handsome commander, very charismatic. All the girls in this little town called Qusair wanted to marry him. And he started off as something as a moderate. In fact, when people were kidnapping Christians in Qusair, he tried to put a stop to it. A couple of years into the conflict, he had no money, his men had no money, they were chased into the hills, they were literally starving. And along comes ISIS with a large sack of cash and says, all you have to do is swear allegiance to us and we will look after you. Abu Walid felt he had no alternative but to become an ISIS commander. Another year after that, he was killed attacking a Christian village in Lebanon. A lot of people made that journey. To a lot of people, at some point in the war, ISIS seemed like a logical alternative. But it was quite a practical calculation. And this is another reason why the support for ISIS may drop off fairly quickly. If they no longer have the money, if they no longer have the resources, if they no longer look like winners, a lot of people who are just simply pragmatic and not ideological will turn away from them.
And the people who are leaving ISIS, who are they joining? What's the logical route for them after they leave ISIS?
For a lot of people, it's Nusra, as they used to be known, because they've just changed their name just to the Syrian front rather than the Nusra front. And that's why over the past few months alone, according to some calculations, Nusra have got 2,000 to 3,000 new recruits. You'll see a lot of back and forth like that. Bear in mind that in the very beginning, ISIS was part of Nusra and split off from Nusra. A lot of people find this development quite worrying. Nusra's ideological links to Al-Qaeda haven't really gone. They put out a video last year celebrating 9/11, for instance. They just may be being more stealthy about their wish to attack the West, establishing themselves in places like Syria and Iraq first, moving more slowly, but having the same ultimate aim. And a lot of people think that if the Americans decide not to bomb Nusra because of their change in name, this is a trap.
You also mentioned, obviously, ISIS being in its death throes. Is this, how's this going to play out for the West? Is there going to be more drama expected as a result?
You're already seeing it in the calls from the ISIS leadership for lone wolf attacks. There have been lone wolf attacks in Orlando, in Paris, in Nice. The death throes of the caliphate, drawn out as they may be, and I don't think it's going to disappear overnight, I think you're going to see a lot of very, very motivated young fighters, some of them who originally came from Western countries, returning to those countries and intent on taking lives.
That was Paul Wood. And finally, the long-awaited night tube rolls into London's sleepy stations this month. The project was conceived back in the halcyon days of 2014 and was originally scheduled to open this time last year, but widespread industrial opposition saw it delayed indefinitely. With the public now finally able to step aboard the project, will nocturnal transport change the capital's nightlife? And will the much-reviled young fogies of Generation Y embrace the cultural spirit of their parents and grandparents? With me to discuss this is Block co-founder George Hull, Vice reporter Mark Wilding, and Kevin Dunning from TFL. So, George, the night tube's about to launch. Do you think it's going to have a good effect on London's nightlife?
I think it's a fantastic development for anyone planning to go anywhere after hours. Clearly, it's going to make things an awful lot easier. I fear that the policy, while I applaud it, is not entirely consistent with some of the policies which are enacted by local authorities over the enforcement or the interpretation of licensed law planning and all that kind of thing. Evidently, you know, given the number of late night venues in London which have closed or come under very serious threat in recent years, there's something going on in that regard. But certainly the transport mechanism operating after hours can only be of benefit. It's just about whether or not it can be joined up with policy in other areas.
And Kevin, you work for TfL. Can you tell us a bit about what to expect when the night tube launches?
So for us it's an exciting time. It's kind of a continuation of operation. It's great that we just don't stop the service. It stops that build up and that rush to the last train. And there's two sides of it, really. There's the supporting sort of the economics of London and just generally getting people backwards and forwards to work, because there's so many people working night shifts and of course would have to use other means. So there's sort of two sides to it. For me, sort of the analogy is this is like a new flight for us as such. You know, we're expanding and that's brilliant, and London just deserves it. You know, I've worked in a lot of cities around the world. London's my favourite and I think it's the best, and I have to say it's just about time we had this, and it's just the most common sense thing to do.
And Mark, do you think it's going to change people's attitudes towards going out? I mean, you can already get Ubers home and taxis home. Do you think the night tube is going to kind of encourage people to go clubbing more? And
yeah, I would hope so. Yeah, I think the night tube's a great idea, and I think allowing people to get in and out of London sort of all around the clock is great and should hopefully be a boost to nightlife. I think, as George said, it really needs to be coupled with some other changes to the regulation of nightlife, and London should be a 24-hour city, and 24-hour tube makes perfect sense, but doesn't make any sense at all if all the bars and clubs have to close at 3 a.m. and so we need to look at other changes if we really want to support nightlife.
And George, what changes would you like to see if you could click your fingers? What would you?
So I think that the London is, you know, marvellous, exciting, potentially 24-hour kind of global super city. And without transport infrastructure of some kind, be it Uber or trains late at night or whatever, then places don't really happen. I mean, there are pockets of London still that aren't very well connected, and they tend to be the ones that are the least happening, as it were, you know. So there's definitely a connection there. And so I think that any improvement in transport infrastructure is very good. But what I would like to see is a more coherent, connected approach to the way that venues which are open after midnight, is where the issues kind of come about, are regulated by local authorities. And now, to expand on that a little more, I think that the mayor's office, clearly, because they were behind the TfL's move to roll out the night tube, and also central government, you know, DCMS and kind of like, so to say, you know, big politicians, are seriously on board with the need to support the nighttime economy, particularly in London. It was a manifesto pledge of Sadiq Khan. He got very on board with this, and he came in as a mayor on this tip. However, on the ground, the way that licensing and planning laws work is that they are interpreted and they are enacted and they are enforced by local authorities and police. And in many instances, the tone of the conversation there has become very shrill. And the presumption on the part of the local authorities who are actually dealing with this on the ground is that the venues which are open late at night are crime creators, are nuisance creators, are a negative thing which in a kind of locality. And obviously, you know, I accept that local authorities have a duty to represent the residents and the people who elect them. But I think that in some instances, and there are many, many examples, they have rather overstepped the mark. And the conversation is kind of, you know, the nighttime industries have rather lost control of the conversation there, which is why, you know, just this week, you know, I operate a venue in Hackney Wick on the kind of outer reaches of East London. There were three venues there which are open after midnight. Two of them announced their closing this week, and mine's the only, you know, and this isn't even in central. This isn't even in Shoreditch. This isn't even in a particularly wealthy part of even central Hackney. So clearly something's going on, and I think that the balance of the conversation needs to be redressed. And the night tube being rolled out is an excellent lens by which to kind of interpret and to kind of refract this situation.
Yes, I mean, in some ways, because and you can hear the concerns, and is that it are the concerns when it talks about nightlife around policing and safety, and obviously that's a real part of our push, was the increased actually policing that we're putting into London over the nighttime period, and then we review that once we're a few months in, and maybe it's time that we get this running and we have the conversation, because we're all about, I mean, it kind of supports each other. At the end of the day, we want ridership to create revenue to invest into the railway. It's ever decreasing. So for me, it's a time that we start to speak to some of the businesses, and even through some of our commercial development areas of the business, to kind of say, well, how do we make this work then? You know, how do you get to a point where everybody's happy? We're in a position that we trust, you know, nighttime economy, we trust, whether it be pubs, bars, whatever that would be. And we could create that balance really across London. London is still one of the safest cities in the world. For me, the actual additional transportation that says, you know, I'm putting, even if it's my family and my daughter, although she's not quite old enough yet, but she will be, to a point that's saying I'm putting them on a train to get them home, that just feels right and it feels safe. So we just need to probably work together to understand how those two can actually link and start to support the economy.
And in George's piece, Mark, he talks about people travelling to Berlin and Amsterdam. It was the easy jet set, is how you referred to it. Do you think there's an opportunity now for London to become a kind of one of those cities that people travel to because they want to go out?
Yeah, I mean, I think the 24-hour tube does represent a big opportunity, actually. I mean, if people are able to get home around the clock, then it tackles many of the perceived problems there are about nightlife, where you know, people complain about noise and, you know, big groups of people on the street. And if people can leave clubs at, you know, the time that they want, then it actually tackles many of the problems that people associate with nightlife. But as I said before, it really has to be coupled with a different approach to licensing, where we allow venues to sort of have the longer hours. Again, as George was talking about before, in Hackney, this weekend, Dance Tunnel, widely regarded as one of the best clubs in London, and, you know, that's closing this week. And, you know, that's just a few days before the 24-hour tube starts running. So that kind of shows the difference in approach, perhaps, between City Hall and local government. And so I think we need a change across the board, not just kind of messages about how we're supporting nightlife.
Mm. And George, do you know of clubs that are planning to open because of the night tube? Is that
very few at this stage, although that's not to say that the effect of the infrastructure may kind of make that potentially possible in the future. The reality situation is that as London becomes wealthier and more developed, and this has happened in various localities, you know, right the way back to Soho, Chelsea, Shoreditch, Dalston, now Hackney Wick and further east, Often one of the first things which happens is that a cheap area, which is kind of like underutilized or a bit rough, people move there because it's cheap, and people open venues there because they kind of can and because they can afford to. And as a result of that, creative, you know, bright young things, artists, whatever, you know, in short, it's tech startups, move there because it's kind of cool, and then it becomes kind of a bit fashionable, and then it becomes wealthy. And then as soon as it becomes wealthy, then all of a sudden the local authorities are less interested in what would, they're actually rather averse to there being venues there which open after 11 or 12. And that's exactly what's happened in this cycle in East London over and over again. And what I think needs to change is that the understanding of this process, which the mayor's office clearly understand, which is why they wanted the night tube, needs to be filtered down. Also, the central government position needs to be filtered down to local authorities who ought to begin to understand the cultural and economic benefit, mediate more effectively with neighbours, and have a kind of a coherent policy for a 24-hour city. In other cities like Berlin and Amsterdam, they got on this quite a long time ago, you know, maybe 10 or 20 years ago. There's a nighttime mayor in Amsterdam who I've met, who's a very clever guy, and, you know, he says the night is problematic. Yeah, like, people do make noise when they leave clubs, and, you know, there are safety issues of people being out late at night and these kinds of things, but it also brings its benefits, and we have to kind of like work together. We all share this city, we appreciate it does have regeneration benefits, as I've described, and it does have economic, cultural benefits, and if we work together and we have a kind of a balanced conversation, then it would be possible to have an exciting, genuinely 24-hour city. I mean, there is provision for 24-hour licences in the 2003 Licensing Act. It's just that very, very few have ever been granted, and that's probably because the local authorities have their own agenda, you know, and we're in a rather authoritarian one these days at that.
And Kevin, obviously it's on the Central Line and Victoria Line, is that where it's about?
That's right, yes.
And what are the plans kind of beyond that?
So as we go forward, there's five lines in scope. So the first two lines, excitingly for 19th, will be Central and Vic, and then we move forward through to the Jubilee, the Northern and the Piccadilly line, so that they will come later in the year. And then that will give us a network that's a really useful network across London. It kind of covers most of the areas. I've had a few complaints where it doesn't come to me as such, so that's a great thing for me, because it starts to promote demand for us, and we can look further. But yes, that's the first five lines.
That was George Hull, Mark Wilding and Kevin Dunning on the Night Tube. That's all for this week. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. And if you enjoy the podcast, why not try out the magazine? Reward yourself this weekend and pick up a copy of the most provocative magazine in Britain. We have a new trial offer for podcast listeners. Get 12 issues for just £12 by visiting spectator.co.uk/12. Thank you for listening, and do join us again next week.